Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And it's Ask Me Anything. And you're like, yeah, but I'll never get in. No, you can get in. There's two lines open right now. I don't know why there's two lines open, but there are. If you've got a question for Jimmy, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. The podcaster behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World that is wildly popular. I never go anywhere to give a talk or anything where somebody doesn't go, I love Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And I'm like, can we make this all about me? And they're like, no, I want to talk about Jimmy. But now we got the Jimmy Akin podcast added to the mix. That's Mondays. Mondays, Jimmy Akin podcast. I'm giving you your schedule now. Mondays, Jimmy Akin podcast. Fridays, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What's up with, if you want to do last Monday, next Monday, just tell me what's up with the Jimmy Akin podcast.
Well, this last Monday, I had an episode come out on racism, and I talked about racism. I talked about the ways people tried to defend it in the past using the Bible, and I talked about why it's nonsense that, you know, the human family is one human family, and cosmetic differences like what your skin color is, what your hair color is, what your eye color is, none of that matters to God, and therefore none of it is to matter to us either. We are called to love everybody. Love your neighbor as yourself is the second great commandment, and Jesus indicates that our neighbor even includes our enemies. So that means we're to love absolutely everybody. That doesn't mean you don't get mad at people, because you can be mad at people that you love, but it does mean that we have to will the good of everybody and recognize them as valuable creatures of God for whom Christ died, and desire and work for the goal of their being saved and going to heaven. So we're called to love everybody, and racism is an ideology that conflicts with that. And I was really surprised at the response that this video got. It came out last Monday, and bunches of people were saying things like, oh, nobody believes in racism, and like, you need to get out more.
Wow.
You need to talk to some more people, because there are racists out there. And other people, it is just such a chaos of different views that people responded with. I'm always extremely careful in how I phrase things, and some people seem to think I was advocating a particular political agenda. Well, no, I'm not. I'm talking, I do a theology. Jimmy Akin podcast is a theology podcast. It's not a politics podcast. So I'm making a theological point. God loves everybody, and we need to love everybody too. And I'm not saying anything about politics one way or another. I never talk politics, except for pointing out the inflation that the government has caused. But that's a separate matter. That's actually not politics. That's economics. But it got a huge amount of response. And so if you want to see what the hullabaloo is about, check it out. Wow. Also, coming out this next Monday, I have an episode on what's called the synoptic problem. There are three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that are very similar to each other, and so they're called the Synoptic Gospels. Synopsis, it comes from Greek roots. Sun means together, and opsis means seeing, so a synopsis is something where you're seeing the same thing together. And so it's like Matthew, Mark, and Luke view the life of Christ in very similar terms. That's why they're called the Synoptic Gospels. And they're so similar to each other that scholars have said, you know, it looks like there's a relationship between them. So maybe we can figure out what that relationship is. And that's what the synoptic problem is. How are Matthew, Mark, and Luke related to each other? And there are a bunch of different proposals that have been suggested, and I go through the basic ones. So if you've ever wondered how they're related, I lay out the basic options. And even though in this episode I don't go into the evidence why, I also mention which one I think the evidence supports.
All right. I stay out of politics, Jimmy. The next thing you know, you'll be doing one on, like, you coming out against adultery. And everyone knows that's just politics. That's just like, well, that's funny to think of. Oh, you're
against racism?
I'm against
adultery.
I know. Next thing you know, you'll be coming out against theft. And then we'll just have to, Jimmy, stay out of it. It's none of your business. That's politics. If you want to talk to Jimmy right now, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. All right, let's go to Alexandria, Virginia, where Will is watching on YouTube. Welcome, Will. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Hi, Will. Oh, I think you're on mute.
Hey, guys, sorry. Took a second to
That's okay.
Yeah, sorry.
You're welcome here.
Took a second to get off mute. Thanks. Yep, and I appreciate it. Jimmy, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Sorry to digress real quick. So little anecdote, I got the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. I was really fired up, and I said, you know what? I've wondered about the Nephilim for so long. I'll bet you Scott Hahn and Curtis Mitch won't let me down. And I get to Genesis, and there's no footnote on it. There's no explanation. And so I say to myself, you know what? I'll bet you Jimmy has me covered. And sure enough, I think like a week or two ago, you had a Mysterious World episode on it. So I thought that was really fun. I wanted to share that. Sorry.
That's interesting. I don't have the Old Testament of the Ignatius Study Bible. It'd be very interesting if they don't have a footnote going into the different theories. Huh? My suspicion, and this is just my first reaction, I'd have to check with the publisher at Ignatius to verify this, but my suspicion is there may have been a fight about that, and the easiest solution was let's get rid of the footnote and not address it at all.
Let's go.
Yeah. I apologize. I might be overstating a little bit. They might have just said, you know, they're mythological giants. But, you know, there's a lot of other footnotes in there. They go into great detail
right.
and explanation. It's really wonderful. But I was disappointed, but you didn't let me down, though. So thank you. Thank you very much. So since it's St. Ignatius' feast day, and I think other folks have called in as well, a question I had was, were there other apostles that are associated with founding, major Christian centers in the early church? You know, like, I guess, like St. James the Great was Bishop of Jerusalem. And I think St. Ignatius can be traced lineage-wise back to St. John, I think. But I know there are stories of other apostles traveling and founding churches and evangelizing. But I was wondering if there's any other kind of cornerstone churches that are tied to other denominations that are affiliated with the Catholic Church, like in the East, let's say.
Yeah, Will, I need to pause you for a second because you're cutting in and out a little bit, and I haven't been able to hear everything you've said. Could you frame the question concisely so that I can make sure I understand it?
Sure, sorry. Are there churches in the Catholic East, let's say, that are associated with an apostle?
Yes.
Your turn. Go ahead. Back to you. Will?
Oh, okay. Which ones are they?
There we go.
Which ones there are?
Well, so it's going to depend on how you use the term apostle. If you mean one of the 12, you know, there are the Martoma Christians over in India that trace their lineage back to St. Thomas the Apostle. Obviously all of the places that St. Paul founded are associated with him. And some of them are in the East, you know, places. He's also associated with Antioch, although that's also associated with Barnabas and with Peter. James is associated with Jerusalem, but he didn't found the church in Jerusalem. Alexandria, Egypt, is associated with Mark, who wasn't one of the 12, but was a companion of the apostles and thus lived in the apostolic generation. If you want to know, now you'll encounter claims about the apostles and their fates and where they went that in many cases are kind of shaky. If anyone confidently tells you here is exactly where all the 12 apostles went, they're exaggerating. We don't have evidence that would allow us to establish exactly where they went and exactly not where all of them went, and exactly which churches they founded. There are some churches that have traditional attributions to certain apostles, and I've mentioned some of those. But if you want a scholarly look at the actual evidence we have regarding what the apostles did, I recommend a book by the Protestant author Sean McDowell, who did a really good and scholarly investigation of this question. The book is called The Fate of the Apostles, and he goes through the major members, not just of the 12, but the broader apostolic community. And in some cases, we have really good evidence for where these apostles ended up. This is like Peter, Paul, James. Thomas is kind of on a second level, and some of them we have very little reliable data on. The data we have comes, it's not that we don't have data, it's just that it comes from multiple centuries later, and we have conflicting sources in some cases. So the ones we can be really confident of are like Peter, Paul, and James. And then it starts to drop off and drops off more precipitously the further down the list you go.
Okay, Will?
That's great. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, yeah, no, it's great. Thanks, guys. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye. Will, thank you very much for the call and for getting us started this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more questions for Jimmy. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Now, some people, they seem to be born angry. I mean, they're kicking and screaming from day one. And if you say something to them, they say, well, that's the way I was made. Apple sauce. Nobody was made angry.
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything. Off we go to Las Vegas, Nevada. Jonathan in Las Vegas, you are next. Thanks for the call, Jonathan. Go ahead with the question. Jonathan?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a question, but it's curiosity.
It needs to be.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead, Jonathan. You got a question?
Okay. I'm just at a question for Mr. Akins or even the apologetics, but for the converts that come to the Catholic Church, there's got to be a driving force for them to convert on a personal level, whatever it may be. But what is it about the conversion to the Catholic Church that they see now, that they've crossed over that chasm, if you will, and they can just look back to their friends who are family members or whoever it may be, if you're on TV, the dispensationalists or the Protestants or reformers who are preaching, whatever, what could they go back and say, you know, I wish you knew this about the Catholic Church, because if you did, you would convert as well. Is there a compelling, is it personal experience for different individuals who convert or a convert to the Catholic Church? Obviously, overcoming the, you know, the Mary, you know, the Pope, the infallibility, you know, and the list goes on and on.
But you're looking for one compelling argument about why.
Once you're in, yeah, I'm
you want to know.
Just said from a personal, since he's a convert.
Oh, so you would like to know for Jimmy personally what's the convincing thing that got him in?
Yeah, I mean, now that he's in
yeah.
in the club. in the Catholic world.
In the club.
That he can look back and he wish he can tell his Protestant friends, hey, if you only knew what, you know, whether it's the sacraments, whether whatever it is, and
sure.
about the Catholic Church that they misunderstand on the other side.
Okay.
That would draw them just like, you know, that would convert them.
Is that clear to you, Jimmy?
Compelling argument to them.
I can deal with it. I can answer.
Okay. Thank you. Well, go ahead, Jimmy.
Okay. So what the answer to this question is going to vary from one person to another because people come to the church for multiple different reasons. God reaches different people through different means and different people are going to be struck by the importance of things differently. And this is something we see in the Old Testament, you know, in the New Testament. Some New Testament figures came to the Christian faith because of, for example, Old Testament prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. But others were struck by the Christian example. You know, in some of the letters, there are exhortations, for example, to Christian women to relate to their husbands in such a way that they'll be won to the Christian faith by their example of living a holy Christian life. And so different people, some people are going to be impressed by Old Testament arguments. Some people are going to be impressed by the example of Christian holiness. Some people are going to be persuaded by the resurrection of Christ. It's going to vary from one person to another. In my own case, I had an intellectual conversion, and that conversion, because I had a background in theology generally, I had to go over every area of systematic theology with an open mind to whether the Catholic perspective on it might be correct. And when I did that, I concluded the Catholic perspective was correct. So there wasn't a single thing that that led me to become Catholic, but there was an ignition point, and that ignition point was when I was reading a book by a Catholic author who had an extended quotation of Matthew 16 in it. And I had always said that when Jesus says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church," that Jesus was contrasting Peter with the rock. So he's like, "You're not the rock, Peter. This other thing is." And as I was reading it this particular day, it struck me that there are structural features in the text. They're so obvious, they're even obvious in English. You don't have to go to the Greek. And they demand that Peter be the rock that Jesus is talking about. And so I realized in a flash, I have to change my perspective on what the rock the church is built on is. It is Peter. It may be other things too, but it is Peter. And if that's the case, then if the church is built on Peter, then once Jesus goes back to heaven, Peter's going to be in charge of the earthly church. And that means, I said to myself, Catholics are right. You could describe Peter as the first pope. Now, whether there were to be any later popes was a separate question I'd have to look at. But I had to conclude that Catholics were right, that Peter can be validly described as the first pope. And if they could be right about that, that means they could be right about other things. And so that's what led me to do a review of all of the categories of systematic theology with an open mind towards the Catholic perspective. And I concluded that Catholics were right, and I became a Catholic. Now, it's not like there's one thing that I would propose to all Protestants or non-Protestants as the thing they need to know, because, as I said, God reaches people in different ways. What's a concern to one person may not be a concern to another person, and what's going to be convincing to one person is not what would be convincing to another person. So I can tell you what happened in my case, but if I'm seeking to minister to other people, I'm not going to impose what was impressive to me on them. Instead, I want to ask them questions and say, you know, find out what their concerns are and address their concerns, because that's the most effective way to help people out, is to figure out what their concerns are and then address them. So I wouldn't impose a one-size-fits-all solution of, oh, if only every Protestant in the world could hear this fact, it would convert them. It wouldn't, because people are all different and have different perspectives and different concerns. And the best way to help them is figuring out what their concern is. Now, that's not to say that there aren't certain issues that are more likely to be impressive to people in terms of should they be Catholic or not. The one that was the trigger point for me, you know, Peter being the rock, that's one of the ones that is more central to many discussions of whether one should be Catholic, but it's not the only possible one. But I guess that's what I could say in general terms. If you'd like to know more about what I'd have to say in this area, I gave a talk some years ago to a class that was studying Catholicism at an evangelical seminary. And I have it on my webpage. It's called Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals. And if you Google Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals, then you should be able to find that piece, and it'll go into all this in more detail.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest, down to Houston we go now. Dan is in Houston, Texas, listening on 1430 AM. Glad to have you, Dan. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. My question for Jimmy Akins is, seems to me, if I remember correctly, a few years ago, we had the Pope declare a year of divine mercy. And mm-hmm. It's all about Saint Sister Faustina and divine mercy. I'm wondering if the Pope could, got me to thinking, I'm wondering if the Pope could declare a year of divine judgment. And sure. I'd like to know what you folks, Jimmy in particular, think about that. Would that be a net positive or a net negative for the church to have sure. something like that?
Jimmy?
Well, it's certainly possible. My suspicion is that most recent popes would view that as being a net negative for the church if a pope were to do something, if a pope were to announce a year of divine judgment. It would cause a lot of confusion among many people who would think, oh, is this a sign we're right at the end of the world and the last judgment's about to happen? And it would become, it would lead to the church being mocked by various people who heard that interpretation of it, and they didn't think we're at the end of the world. And then when the world doesn't end at the year of divine judgment, it's like, ah, see, I told you. This just shows how ridiculous the Pope is, and so forth. Also, the message of God's mercy is, even though both judgment and mercy are important, God's mercy is ultimately the one that we as Christians need to focus more on. We need to have an awareness of God's judgment, and we need to take it seriously, but we need to have an even greater appreciation for God's mercy and an even greater focus on it, because that's why Jesus came and died on a cross for us. It wasn't so God could judge us. It was so God could be merciful to us. And it's God's mercy that's at the core of the Christian message. God's judgment is a secondary matter as part of the message that the church has to proclaim to the world. It's an important thing that the church has to proclaim to the world, but it's not the primary thing. So I suspect most popes would view proclaiming a year of divine judgment as something that would cause more confusion. It also would cause a lot of people to become scrupulous and fearful. And I suspect most popes would think it would be a net negative, at least at this point in history.
You know what? We lost Dan. I hope Dan was still listening, but Dan,
I hope he's still saved. I want him to have God's mercy.
You don't lose your salvation for hanging up, do you?
No, you said he'd been lost. You said we lost him.
You're right. I said we lost Dan, and I did not mean that in the metaphysical sense. I don't even know what metaphysical is. I didn't mean that in the sense of his salvation. I just meant he's not on the phone anymore, Jimmy.
Okay. Glad you clarified. I would have had no clue otherwise.
I'm sure you were very confused on that. Hey, get ready to snag some absolutely fire deals at shop.catholic.com. Like, everything is on sale. Every Jimmy Akin book, every Cy Kellett book, that's me, every single drop from the Catholic Answers crew, one of the biggest Catholic book collections in the whole dang internet. Why am I reading this? What is it? Am I supposed to be cool like reading this? I don't. All on sale. We're talking 10 to 25% off and some even spicier. I'm not getting this. But wait, it gets even better. Deals on Bibles, School of Apologetics. Check it all out. It's a big giant sale. Shop.catholic.com. Hey, there's lines open right now. Perfect time to call if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884. You keep your salvation even if you accidentally hang up.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
I knew we were going to get a little groovy music. Get that for the end of the week when Jimmy's here with us. Ask me anything on Catholic Answers Live this hour, 888-318-7884. Going up to Bangor, Maine, where Ethan is watching on YouTube. Hi, Ethan.
Hi.
Got a question for Jimmy?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
A question.
Right into the phone, Ethan.
Yes, sir.
That sound good now.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Vatican I says the papacy cannot defect, right?
Cannot. Well, it implies that, yes. Can't defect, uh-huh.
But question, just as like a appeal to free will, like the Pope has the right, though, to leave the truth for the faith, so, or embrace heresy, right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand that.
So the Pope has the ability to leave the faith, right?
Sure, that's a legitimate theological opinion.
So if the Pope can leave the faith or fall into heresy, how can the Bishop of Rome be guaranteed not to fall?
Well, an individual pope is not guaranteed not to fall. I mean, you could have, and in fact, in the history of the early church, there is even some evidence that during the age of persecutions, one bishop of Rome did leave the Christian faith. But that's different than what happens with an individual who has the office of Pope is different than what the person is doing when they are acting as Pope. That in itself is different than the ongoing institution of the papacy. Christ promised that his Christ promised that his church would not have the gates of hell prevail against it, or the gates of Hades. And so his church is never going to die. And he willed that, that his church have the office of the papacy. And so from that, we can infer that there is a very high likelihood Christ is going to preserve the institution of the papacy in his church. But that's not the same as saying every single person who ever enters the office of the papacy is destined never to leave it. In fact, popes can and do leave it. Pope Benedict XVI left it. He was elected pope. He entered into the office of the papacy, and then he left the papacy. So you don't even have to worry about, you know, someone leaving the Christian faith or something like that. They can just leave the papacy. So what this illustrates is that there is a difference between the office of the papacy itself, which endures through the church, and what an individual pope does when he is pope, such as teaching something infallibly, which is something an individual person who is the pope can do. And then a third issue is, will this person stay pope, or will he depart from the papacy in some means, either voluntarily or by renouncing the Christian faith, which is what apostasy is, or through some other means?
Sorry, I was just asking that, is that, like, for example, like, if a pope fell into, like, a heresy, like, wouldn't that be – I'm Eastern Orthodox, so maybe this is where the confusion is. What does that mean by the definition, the office itself would be lost because the person in holding the office is now – pressing decrees that are against the office?
No, not from a Catholic perspective. There's been a discussion historically of what would happen if a pope fell into heresy. And the answer, there are a range of opinions, and I can't go through them all at the moment. One opinion is that if a pope did fall into manifest heresy, he would simply cease to be pope. So then a new pope could be elected, just like after Pope Benedict XVI renounced the papacy, a new pope was elected. So anytime the office becomes vacant, a new pope can be elected. And according to one historical opinion, if a pope falls into public heresy, he would thereby vacate the office and a new pope could be elected. So we have to, on a Catholic point of view, and now that's one opinion, there are other opinions, and not all of them involve the pope automatically losing office. But just to point to one opinion that does illustrate the principle that there is a difference between the office and what happens with the office, and an individual and what happens with that individual, merely because a pope fell into heresy would not automatically mean that the papacy itself had fallen. It might, for example, just mean, well, this guy's no longer pope.
But since the pope is like the ultimate, like, authority on who is, what is the teaching of the church, by what authority would any other agents other than the pope denounce the pope? The only group that could denounce the pope would be the pope, right? Because he's the ultimate teacher. If you go against the ultimate teacher, you're going to get, you would have to be debating the pope on its validity, right?
You wouldn't have to be debating the pope about the validity of the papacy, but you would, if a pope taught heresy, then, you know, I mean, we're in uncharted waters, because this is something that's never happened, and by the grace of God, it will never happen. But if it were to happen, there are a number of possible scenarios. one possibility is that the members of, for example, of the College of Cardinals might denounce the Pope for heresy and alert the Catholic community to the problem that the Pope was creating by teaching heresy. On the other hand, the Pope, let's say a Pope came to the conclusion that the Trinity is false, and that God is really a Unitarian view of God is correct rather than a Trinitarian. Well, at that point, he might say, you know, I know I was elected as the Pope, but I think that the Trinity is false now, and I don't think Jesus is God, and so I'm just going to retire from the papacy. So that's another scenario that could happen. Now, what would happen in a concrete circumstance is something we don't know, because what would happen would depend on the choices the Pope made and the choices other people made. And it's all hypothetical, but and there might be difficulty discerning exactly what happened with the Pope. You know, people could argue, well, was this heresy or not? And what were the exact consequences of him becoming a heretic? But there's even an argument that he wouldn't lose the papacy. The way canon law is written, he would not lose the papacy. None of this challenges the distinction in Catholic thought between the individual who occupies the office and the office itself.
Ethan, I tell you what, I'm going to leave it there because we do have lots of folks on the line and only a short time left. But thank you for the call. I hope it was helpful, and you're certainly welcome to call back again another time as questions come up. I want to go to Polk City, Iowa, where Eric is listening on Iowa Catholic Radio. Glad to have you, Eric. Go ahead with your question. Hi, Eric.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead with your question.
My question is, are there any Catholic study Bibles you'd recommend? If you have one or two or whatever, I just wanted to see if you had some recommendations.
Well, I don't really use study Bibles myself. I go straight to commentaries. But one that I have a favorable impression of that I can recommend to others would be the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. That doesn't mean I'd agree with everything in its notes, but on balance, it's a really good work. So I could recommend that one to you.
Okay, Eric.
How do you say that? How do you spell that, Ignatian?
Ignatius, I-G. Yeah. Natius. Ignatius.
Thank you, Eric, very much for the call. Hope that was helpful to you. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1984. Mother Angelica Live is the only religious program nominated for an award for cable excellence. Later in the year, she wins a Gabriel Personal Achievement Award from Catholic broadcasters and communicators.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. What does it win? Quick. We're almost at the end. We've got a bunch more folks on the line, though, so off we go to try to get everyone on that wants to talk with Jimmy Akin. We're going to Houston, Texas for the second time this hour. Paul in Houston, Texas, listening on 1430 AM. Welcome, Paul. Go ahead with your question.
Yes. How does Jimmy Swaggart Ministries or the Pentecostal Church compare to Catholicism?
Well, so Jimmy Swaggart Ministries is one particular ministry that's part of the broader Pentecostal movement. And, you know, I don't know exactly how to compare an individual ministry to the Catholic Church. In fact, it's somewhat difficult to compare something as broad as the Pentecostal movement to the Catholic Church. But fundamentally, I mean, there are any number of similarities and differences. I don't know which ones you're interested in. The Pentecostal movement itself is a, I mean, it's, I guess I need to ask a clarifying question, which is, what are you counting as Pentecostal? Because, for example, some people would count Oneness Pentecostals as Pentecostal, and they don't even believe in the Trinity. Others would restrict the term Pentecostal to Trinitarian Pentecostals, like, for example, the Assemblies of God. Others might expand the term to include Charismatics, who are members of other Protestant, who are members that exercise charismatic gifts, which is one of the hallmarks of the Pentecostal movement, but that are found in other denominations like Baptists, Lutherans, Methodists, and so forth. So when you refer to the Pentecostal church, what are you referring to, Paul? How broadly or narrowly are you using that term?
Well, as pertains to Jimmy Swaggart, they believe in the Trinity.
Mm-hmm, yep.
I was watching one of their programs, and they are anti-Catholic.
Yep.
They call it a false faith, and saying that the foundation that's built on is wrong, and praying to Mary, considering that almost idolatry, and the communion of saints as praying to dead people.
So Paul, it sounds like you have a good understanding of many aspects of Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. How can I be of assistance to you?
Well, would it be a favorable or unfavorable comparison as far as Pentecostalism?
Now, are you asking about Jimmy Swaggart? Are you asking about Jimmy Swaggart Ministries in particular, or Pentecostalism more broadly?
Let's just say Jimmy Swaggart, if you're familiar.
Oh, I'm quite familiar with Jimmy Swaggart.
Oh,
I'm very familiar.
Okay.
So I would say that Jimmy Swaggart himself he presented himself as someone who was trying to serve God, but he had a variety of very serious flaws. Some of his flaws were personal and moral in nature, like his dalliance with prostitutes. Other flaws he had were of a theological nature, like the anti-Catholicism that he taught. Despite his flaws, he was able to help various people grow closer to God, and that's good. So I think Jimmy Swaggart, like everybody, has a mix of, and his ministry has a mix of both good and bad qualities. In his case, his personal views and his personal flaws were rather significant. And they're not shared by all Pentecostals, but since you asked about him and his ministry specifically, that's what I'd have to say about them.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. On I go, trying to see how many we can get on here with Jimmy. Greg is in Moscow, Idaho. Greg, welcome. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of your guys' show. We have two questions for you,
okay.
If you have time. One, can Jesus hear our prayers like when we just pray inside of our head with our own internal monologue, or do we have to speak them out loud? And my 7-year-old has another question.
Well, let's get your first one addressed.
Jesus was a little boy, was he a good boy?
Okay, that one I'm going to let Cy Kellett answer for us. Cy Kellett, when Jesus was a little boy, was he a good boy?
He was the best. He was a very good boy.
Okay, So that takes care of Greg's seven-year-old's question. In terms of can God hear our mental prayers, yes, God is omniscient. He therefore knows everything, or everything that's possible to know. Like, he doesn't know the shape of a four-sided triangle, because that's a nonsense string of words. There's no such thing as a four-sided triangle, because it involves a logical impossibility. But knowing the thoughts of another person does not involve a logical impossibility, so God knows that. He knows everything, therefore he knows our thoughts. So he is aware of our mental prayers. And this is something that is indicated, that God knows our thoughts. It's indicated in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in fact, Jesus, in his ministry, displays a knowledge of what other people are thinking in their hearts as they're observing his ministry. So this was Jesus was telepathic. And God definitely knows what's going on inside our minds. In fact, it's proverbial that, you know, man looks at the outside appearance, but God knows the heart.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Well, can you tell us your seven-year-old's first name? We'll just say hello to him.
Oh, well, here, say your name.
Lynn.
Lynn, well, you did a good job. Thank you very much. You sound like a very good boy as well.
Probably not as good as Jesus, but still a good boy.
That's right. That's right. But similar. Thanks, Greg, very much for the call. Off to Phoenix we go, Phoenix, Arizona, where Luke is watching on YouTube. Luke, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin. Hi, Luke.
Oh, hey, guys. So my question is, how do we reconcile the corruption in the medieval ages with the infallibility of the church? And I know that the church needs to make infallible statements and the Pope needs to speak ex cathedra and all that, but you know, there are documented instances of church abuse, you know, then and now. So I was wondering, since the institution is made up of men making spiritual decisions, how can we make sense of that?
Okay. Well, let's take a look at the very first pope of all, St. Peter. Luke, you're going to help me answer this question. Did St. Peter ever commit grave sins? Did he, for example, He, for example, denied Jesus. So St. Peter committed grave sins. Okay, now, did St. Peter write two books of the New Testament?
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did, 1st and 2nd Peter. Are 1st and 2nd Peter divinely inspired by God?
Yes, they are.
Okay, and are books that are divinely inspired by God protected from containing error?
Yes, they are.
So if St. Peter committed grave sins, but nevertheless wrote 1st and 2nd Peter, which are divinely inspired and therefore protected from teaching error, then St. Peter was able to commit infallible acts, namely writing 1st and 2nd Peter, even after he had committed grave sins. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, so this would suggest to us that the personal moral conduct of a pope has nothing to do with whether that person exercises a teaching ministry in a way that God chooses to protect from containing error. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree.
Okay.
If I could follow up
sure.
a question
okay.
In regards to that, where now obviously it's not one person making church decisions now or then, but it's usually the magisterium. So it's scripture, sacred tradition, and the magisterium. How exactly does the magisterium work? And I don't know if this would be too long. I know you guys are trying to wrap up the show.
We got time for you.
How exactly does the magisterium work?
So the magisterium is the bishops of the world teaching in union with the Pope. And it operates in a variety of different ways, which are fundamentally the Holy Spirit guides the magisterium in its teaching ministry. And that guidance ordinarily does not result in infallibility. It still results in substantial accuracy. Even when the church is not teaching infallibly, what it says is still substantially accurate. But then in limited circumstances, the magisterium, either through the Pope or through an ecumenical council, or when the bishops are scattered throughout the world, can engage the church's infallibility and produce an infallible teaching. I actually have an entire book on the magisterium and how it works. It's called Teaching with Authority. And since it's kind of a big subject that, and I'm not sure that I've plumbed the depths of your question, there are probably multiple different aspects to your question. I suggest, Sykelet, why don't we send Luke a copy of Teaching with Authority?
Luke, will you give us an address and we can send that to you?
Absolutely.
Well, Luke, thank you very much. Hang on. Edgar will get your address, and we will get that out to you. Very odd situation, Jimmy. Calls that we had dropped, we actually finished early with Jimmy Akin here. I don't recall that happening. I cannot
recall. Well, you haven't pumped calls in the last 30 minutes. Could have something to do with it.
Yeah, I think I kind of get out of the habit of pumping calls, as you say. Because, you know, you're here. I just figure you'll draw them. I figure why do my job? You're going to draw people.
there can be exceptions.
Yeah.
But speaking of exceptions, if we have someone call in now, we'll
just
just take them. I don't have a problem. I used to listen to Art Bell, and he'd just say, caller, you're on the air.
All right. That's what we're going to do. 888-318-7884. If I see that, when I see that light line up, you're straight in here with me and Jimmy, and I'll get you right on with him. I'm looking right at the phones right now. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the Jimmy Akin podcast, and everybody else's podcast. Who's give me a list of a podcast you have not been on this week. That's what I thought.
That I have not been on? Well, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of podcasts, and so there are hundreds of thousands I haven't been on this week.
All right, here we go. Ready to go?
Yep.
Hello, you're on the air with Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live. Who we got?
Hey there. This is Royce.
Hi.
I'm just calling in. I'm driving up to my cabin.
You're driving up your cabin? I'm glad you're getting away for the weekend, Roy. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yeah. I just wanted to hear Jimmy kind of go into this idea of infallibility within people. I mean, that's kind of a big statement.
Yeah, well, okay, so what infallibility means is not capable of being wrong. And infallibility per se is a quality that only God has. Only God is ultimately unable to be wrong. But God can protect other people so that what they say is not wrong. And that's the claim that that the Christian church makes, for example, for the writings of Scripture. They were inspired, even though they were written by human beings like, you know, St. Matthew and St. Luke and St. John and St. Paul, they were also inspired by God, so that God was working in the background. And one of the things he did was he protected the biblical authors from making mistakes when they wrote. And so they communicate firmly and faithfully and without error the truth that God wanted put in them. And we can therefore trust the documents of the New Testament. Well, God can arrange it so that people are also protected from error in other circumstances. And the church has discerned that God has agreed to do that with the bishops and the Pope in limited circumstances. So in limited circumstances, Christians can have confidence that when the Pope has taught something, it is guaranteed to be true. It is not wrong.
Roy, I'm so grateful you stopped and called on your way to the cabin. I've got a couple of book ideas for you that I'll give you for free, and you pick the one you want, because we didn't get to know you well, Roy. If you want a Jimmy Akin's book, A Daily Defense, it's got 366 different articles, one-pagers on the Catholic faith, or he's got a book called The Bible is a Catholic Book. You just tell Edgar, line three, Edgar, what book you want, and we will send it off to you. Have a great weekend, Jimmy Akin. Thank you. That will do
My
it for
pleasure.
Us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.